From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you. Thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Please let me take a moment here to point out that the opinions expressed on our program do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of this radio station or Interfaith Alliance. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, many Americans went to the polls on Tuesday, and there were some interesting results. After courts declared that Virginia's voting districts had become unconstitutionally gerrymandered, for years, a more representative election this week led to overwhelmingly Democratic outcomes. Often, re-election for trailblazing candidates is even more significant than winning office for the first time. So it's noteworthy that Danica Rome, the first openly transgender state legislator, won a second term also in Virginia. She pulled it off despite a well-funded, religion-infused, and anti-transgendered hate campaign to defeat her.
If you lose, they're going to say Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
With an endorsement like this in the Kentucky governor's race, only one outcome in such a red state would be possible, right? But no. In a very close race, the actual winner was Democratic Attorney General Andy Beshear. And a strange little election story, again from Virginia. A woman who lost her job after a photograph of her making an obscene gesture directed at the presidential motorcade went viral a couple of years ago has unseated a longtime incumbent for county representative. Oh, one more from Virginia, okay? With her win of a school board seat in Fairfax County, 24-year-old Abrar Omish becomes the first Muslim woman elected to public office in the state. An overt hate campaign failed to derail her campaign. Meanwhile, a known white supremacist in Colorado has been arrested and charged with planning to blow up a synagogue in the city of Pueblo. In meetings with undercover FBI agents, the suspect explained a multi-stage plot to terrorize Jews in Colorado and beyond. Now, Donald Trump's longtime spiritual advisor, prosperity gospel preacher Paula White, is now prospering at taxpayer expense. She has been hired as the official advisor to Trump's Faith and Opportunity Initiative. What a surprise. She's always said, wherever I stand is holy ground. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. Where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act. And no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote.
A generation ago, the biggest concern at the intersection of religion, government, and politics was the fear of one religious dogma dominating our secular nation. How times change. Today, a healthy fear of just that would go a long way toward protecting our Constitution and our pluralistic values. A leading expert on issues of religious liberty and church-state separation is attorney Melissa Rogers, who served the Obama administration as a presidential advisor and headed up the White House Office of Faith-Based Partnerships. Melissa's new book is titled Faith in American Public Life, and I look forward to a wide-ranging conversation with her later in this week's show. But first,
what happened to us on a legislative area and across the states, it creates a huge opportunity for strategy to be a game changer in people's lives, their businesses, their campaigns, their organizations, and in whatever's happening in this fight for faith that we see across the country.
No matter how much evidence gets served up, it's maddening that most Americans simply do not recognize the fundamental threat the theocratic religious right poses to our democracy itself. In addition to seizing the levers of power at the highest levels of our federal government, Christian supremacists have effectively worked to advance their agenda of anti-LGBTQ, anti-reproductive rights, anti-religious minority, anti-sex education policies at the state-by-state level under the umbrella name of Project Blitz. A leading investigator of this campaign has long been Frederick Clarkson, senior research analyst at Political Research Associates. While far from enough non-extremist Americans take this threat nearly seriously enough, new reporting from Fred Clarkson demonstrates that the theocrats still think their scheming has become too visible. And so, they are now actively working to rebrand their conspiracy, to rewrite the laws that impact the lives of every single one of us. Fred has just published a comprehensive new exposé of this conspiracy, along with an audio recording of an uncensored conference call held last month. For details, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Fred Clarkson. Fred, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I urge every listener to devote the time to read the entire report with great attention. We do need to make sure everyone hearing this knows what we're up against, though. So start with a very brief description of what Project Blitz is or was.
Well, it still is, even though they're thinking about changing the name. What Project Blitz is a comprehensive state legislative campaign organized by Christian right groups, all under the rubric of religious freedom. And what they've done is they've taken model bills from their best practices and learned experiences from around the country and said, okay, well, there, people may have their own versions, but here's how you would do a bill to post In God We Trust slogans in the public schools, or here's a bill that would be good for promoting religious exemptions and conscience clauses for healthcare workers who disagree, say, with having to treat LGBTQ people for mental health care or to be involved in reproductive health care in various ways. Also to bills that would promote biblical literacy classes in the public schools, sort of a covert form of proselytization, and also bills that would allow for discrimination by religiously based adoption and foster care agencies. We saw that one introduced just this year in Tennessee, for example. So it's a very comprehensive list, all with the idea of promoting religious freedom.
So, by the numbers, how much has this shadowy conspiracy changed the face of America already?
Well, they've successfully introduced in most of the states in the country perhaps something on the order of 150 or 200 bills, of which less than half has passed. But the idea is to drive the public debate. Like in Minnesota, the In God We Trust amendment to another piece of legislation, passed but then was vetoed, and there was an enormous public discussion about it. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of things we're seeing without an awful lot of organized response from the other side.
Congressman Randy Forbes of Virginia is the founder of the Congressional Prayer Caucus, continues to lead the caucus, and is also the head of the National Strategic Center. You have a recording of him talking about a coordinated response to what he sees as attacks on the unfettered theocratization of the lawmaking process. Let's listen to a little bit of that now.
So we actually established the first of its kind National Strategic Center. It's a 10,000 square foot facility that's state of the art. And what we do here is to look and examine strategies that are being used against you, strategies that are being used against those who are trying to fight the fight for faith, and then to help create for you strategies of how you can defend against those, how that you can be more effective in that fight for faith.
So, Fred, what is Forbes talking about there?
Well, he's talking about what sounds like a new space, 10,000-foot National Strategic Center that he makes it sound like it's equipped with staff and computers and databases and all kinds of stuff to inform his national network of state-level prayer caucuses and their state directors with information. Particularly analyzing what he calls the faith landscape of people who are pro-faith in his view and anti-faith in his view, in order to provide ongoing strategic guidance to policymakers and politicians going forward.
So why is this such a great cause of concern for you?
Well, these are folks who don't respect the faith of others. They cast all people who disagree with their religious and their legislative and political agenda as opponents of faith itself. Their faith in particular is conflated with the entire idea of faith. So it's taking McCarthyite smear mongering and entering it into framing the way we discuss religion in public life.
Forbes also talks about action beyond prayer. Let's listen to that.
Sometimes you have to build up support that may not necessarily be directly a piece of legislation. One of those things is called a faith impact group. A faith impact group, we began rolling out these prototypes a couple years ago to fine-tune them and see how they work, but here's basically the concept. A faith impact group could be a group that was a Bible study. It could have been a prayer group. But it is a group that says, we don't want to just pray. We don't want to just study the Bible. We want to make sure afterwards we're getting up and doing something that's actually changing the world around us.
I mean, this says it all, doesn't it?
So this is, again, taking the idea of faith being under attack. Throughout the 40-minute conference call, Randy Forbes and Leah Caron talk about faith being under attack, and therefore, in order to defend faith, they have to advance this particular political agenda. It's a kind of a demagogic strategy that, going forward, is going to certainly stir people up and pit people against one another.
Does this kind of organizing benefit from tax dollars that prayer caucus members control?
Yes and no. I mean, insofar as prayer caucuses are members of the state legislature, they have their own budgets. And I'm not sure whether they managed to divert funds into various things. In one case in Arizona, they passed a state license plate bill in which In God We Trust would be on the license plate. but sometimes you pay special fees for these specialized license plates. And in this case, the fees were diverted, I think, to the tune of $1 million to underwrite the Christian Right Legal Network Alliance Defending Freedom.
Fred, the call that you captured is over 30 minutes long. Not once did I hear words like democracy, equality, patriotism, or any other secular political rhetoric. With over 100 members, what does the Congressional Prayer Caucus ultimately want?
Well, I guess I would argue that they're moving in a decidedly theocratic direction. I think that Randy Forbes and Leah Carawan and their close political ally behind the Project Blitz, David Barton, are pretty explicit about wanting what we've called on this show, you know, dominionism, the idea that there should be a Christian nation of some sort, organized according to what they think to be biblical principles or even Old Testament biblical law.
Who are the caucus partner organizations in organizing and supporting Project Blitz?
Well, there are two. David Barton heads an organization called Wall Builders, and he has his own Wall Builders pro-family legislative network of state legislators. They hold an annual conference in Texas, as a matter of fact. And a second organization, a small Christian right legal group called the National Legal Foundation, which from the audio tape sounds like they're providing a significant amount of the analysis for the National Strategy Center and ongoing legal guidance and legislative guidance.
My guest is Fred Clarkson from Political Research Associates. He has an important update to his groundbreaking reporting on Project Blitz, a theocratic campaign to rewrite our laws state by state in the image of a narrow conservative Christianist vision for our nation. Okay, your new report centers around the cynical rebranding, you call it debranding, of the Project Blitz campaign. Let's listen now to Congressional Prayer Caucus Executive Director Leah Carawan chuckling about the reasons she claims are behind the change.
What can we do as a nation to combat this swarming and these anti-faith groups that are trying to come against us en masse? And out of that came what was formerly called Project Blitz several years ago. And at the center of Project Blitz was this Religious Freedom Measures Toolkit that would actually be useful, that you could pull out and then cut and paste. And many, many, many of you have used those over the course of the last 3 years. And the Project Blitz is now renamed Freedom for All for the same reason, very strategically. The other side finally caught on to what you all were doing and the mass of legislation that was going forth across the nation, the incredible successes all across the nation, and they were scratching their heads saying, what in the world happened? They started talking about Project Blitz, and as soon as we understood that they knew they were onto us, we changed the name, shifted things around a little bit.
Fred, swarming?
That's the kind of apocalyptic scenario that they're urging their people to envision. You know, a swarming of interests out to stamp out faith itself and to cast ordinary citizens, people who may also be of a Christian faith or other faiths, as so fundamentally opposed to their faith and their idea of the advancement of the kingdom of God that they must be snuffed out. It's a very alarming sensibility that comes through with that kind of language. No wonder they adopted the name Project Blitz, and no wonder why they want to hide from it now.
Well, you actually write that she's lying about the reason for this change. Expand on that, if you would.
Well, yeah. I first exposed Project Blitz in April of 2018, and it received massive amounts of unwanted media coverage, and it led to Americans United for Separation of Church and State waging a national campaign focused on Project Blitz, and other coalitions, including the Blitz Watch Coalition, getting together to also take a look at Project Blitz and to try to stop them in state legislatures. And I think it's had an effect. But she claims that they were right on it as soon as they figured out that we knew what was going on, that they were going to change the name.
Hmm.
Well, that turned out not to be the case. Project Blitz webpage on their own website was there, as I learned from the Internet Archive, called the Wayback Machine, at least as of April 25th of this year, and the new page that they have doesn't appear until May. So I don't see when they made the change in that whole year of negative reaction. So they're trying to make it sound like they're right on top of things when actually they're not.
Well, you know, the language that we're hearing is of some kind of desperate fight for faith. And worse, tens of millions of Americans who hold deep religious convictions are viewed as enemies of religious faith simply because they disagree with the extremist views of the Project Blitz types. How did we get to this point where our 100 elected representatives in the U.S. Congress support that kind of extremism? And how many lower-level lawmakers are also complicit at this point?
Well, they claim a network of 950 state legislators at this point. You know, elections come and go, so it can change, to be sure. But that's the number they give, and it sounds about right from what we can see from the named members in the prayer caucuses, some of which are posted on their website. Other prayer caucuses don't name all their members, but, you know, that may not be an exaggeration.
Where do you see this all playing out in our culture? For me, it seems like everything from the Muslim ban to Bible classes in public schools to climate change denial to creationism to protections for so-called religious conscience exemptions and on all fall under the umbrella of the Blitzer agenda.
This is a well-organized network who have organized their activism from around the country over many years, and they've made a really useful series of templates, and they've organized state legislators, you know, in now 38 states into prayer caucuses, and they're shooting for 42 by the end of the year, and ultimately 50 if they get their way. But, you know, this is a focused form of organizing that is not matched well on anywhere to the left of the Christian right.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't seeing these things as connected. You know, it's a bill here, it's a bill there, but it's not widely understood as a comprehensive agenda with an organized network of sponsors.
Fred, under whatever name they adopt, what are these theocrats going to be working on most aggressively in the year ahead?
Well, they haven't published their playbook yet, but we'll certainly hope to get it. Based on the trends from the past couple of years, I think we can expect to see more In God We Trust type legislation, more biblical literacy classes. There were quite a few this year of those bills. And we've seen the trend towards the anti-LGBTQ adoption and foster care legislation as well. So I think that the degree of organization and the more extreme measures we'll see more of, and also the conscience, the religious exemption conscience clause exemptions aimed at both individuals and healthcare institutions like Catholic hospitals, I think we'll probably begin to see them move into that arena more aggressively as well.
Again, I want to urge every listener to carefully read your writing on this critically important subject. Now, beyond that, what do you recommend people of goodwill to do to stay informed and to fight against this kind of redefinition of what America means?
Well, to stay informed around Project Blitz, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and a coalition that has a website called the Blitz Watch Coalition. You can Google it. We have a more or less biweekly newsletter keeping up to date on Project Blitz, and people can get that for free. And I think it's very important for people just to become basically literate in what the Christian right is up to. They're a smart, well-organized political movement with serious intent and demonstrated political competence. And whatever the comings and goings of one election or another, they're a movement to be taken very seriously. And I think that's the starting point. If you take it seriously, the kind of educational and organizing activities follow from there.
Fred Clarkson is Senior Research Analyst at Political Research Associates. His groundbreaking work exposing the nationwide Project Blitz theocratic campaign has led to effective organizing among more moderate voices of faith and facilitated the founding of a coalition-sponsored website, blitzwatch.org. Fred, always good to talk with you. Thank you again for being with us, and you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Elton. I look forward to next time.
Coming up, we have another critically important conversation in a time such as this. I'll talk with Melissa Rogers, former special assistant to President Barack Obama. Her new book is titled Faith in American Public Life. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. I've been fortunate to know Melissa Rogers for many years, dating back to her time at the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. An insightful attorney and articulate writer, she was tapped by the Obama administration to advise the president and lead the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. A much sought-after voice on religious freedom, Melissa has just published a new book titled Faith in American Public Life. Now, if ever there was a book title with a double meaning, both of which are critically important, it's this one. And I am delighted that it brings the author to State of Belief Radio. Melissa, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's great to join you, Welton. Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's been my privilege to work with you over the years, too. So
well,
this is a nice occasion.
This book provides an overview of the mixed role religion has been playing in the life of our nation. But I also think it is an extraordinary expression of faith in the ongoing potential of the American people. Did you have both of those themes in mind when you were writing and ultimately naming the book?
Yes, I love how you said that, Welton, having, you know, both religious faith and then faith in the capacity of the American people and our ability to come together across our many differences in public life and push the nation to new heights. So, yes, both of those things were intended meaning.
At this moment in time, where are you drawing hope from?
Well, I think that, you know, Americans want to uphold the precious guarantees that we have in our Constitution and work together to honor the best traditions of religious liberty in our country. And I have faith that more people are going to move from the sidelines of these debates into solidarity, for example, with people who are being targeted for their faith. I think that most Americans would see that as something that is wrong and want to be of assistance. But they may, with their busy lives, not have been paying as much attention to it as some of us have. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to highlight some challenges that I think are urgent and where we need more voices in the debate saying that there are no second class faiths in the United States Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it is not okay with us to fearmonger on factors like faith, race, and ethnicity. And yes, we do view it as part of our responsibility as citizens to stand with our neighbors who may be fearful just to practice their faith, to wear a yarmulke when they're walking down the street, or mm-hmm. to go to a mosque or gurdwara, or to wear a turban if they're sick. So, I hope that we will be able to have a wider conversation about these issues and energize more people to get involved and take what may have been a private lament for them into public advocacy on these issues.
Melissa, how would you describe the status of religious freedom right now and how that status compares with religious freedom as understood in the First Amendment?
Right. So I think right now we face a real crisis on the ability of some Americans to practice their faith without fear. And this is a situation that I think where our system is really blinking red. We mm-hmm. have people who feel very threatened today, and that is a serious concern in our nation that has prided itself on upholding religious liberty for people of all faiths and none. If we don't feel secure in being able to go to our house of worship or to wear a headscarf if that's our faith, then we really do not have true religious freedom in this country. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say that's a crisis. On other issues, I think we have a yellow flashing sign or light. And I'm concerned about two things in this particular area. One is that we do not want the Supreme Court to break with precedents that say the government should not promote religion. And we know that when the government does promote religion, it inevitably violates the consciences of everyone. It also, secondly, inevitably ends up in creating de facto preferences for some faith over another. Not every faith is going to receive the government's backing. The majority of faiths are going to receive the government's backing, and that may be different from place to place, but that always means that somebody's religion is going to be preferred and other people are going to be shut out. And the third concern about governmental promotion of religion is that it actually harms the faith that the government favors mm-hmm. by tending to make it a creature of the state, by suppressing religious ideas that challenge the state and magnifying religious teachings that align with the state, so that what we're left with is not an authentic expression of religion, but a funhouse mirror version of faith. Mm-hmm. And that, because the government has such a large megaphone, when they're propounding a faith, it can tend to drown out the authentic expressions of religion. And authentic expressions of religion are the ones that have often helped this nation to live up to its highest callings. Think about the civil rights struggle and the work of people of faith and others to call the nation to account on that. Think about the recent family separation policy where, families who cross the Southwest border without papers were torn apart from their parents from children. And we had and have religious people, among others, speaking out about that policy. So we need religious voices to be clear and be authentic, not endorsed by the government and warped and weakened. Mm-hmm. So that's one set of problems. And I think another set of problems relate to our struggle to get the free exercise issues right. Mm-hmm. And here I think we can err on two sides. We can err by overreaching on free exercise issues. And let me give an example of that. I think when the government would turn a blind eye to the fact that a grantee, for example, or a government contractor would be discriminating against someone on the basis of a person who needs government aid on the basis of religion, then and the government saying that's okay because of the free exercise rights of the religious organization, I think that generally speaking, I think that is an overreach and not a proper way to protect free exercise. But on the other side, we sometimes see government underprotecting religious exercise. I think when we think back to the initial articulation of the contraception mandate under the Affordable Care Act, I personally spoke out against the religious exemption there because I felt like it was not adequate to the need to protect religious exercise of the employers who object for religious reasons to providing contraception to their female employees. At the same time, I was very insistent on the fact that women working for objecting employers needed to be able to receive these cost-free contraception coverage as a benefit under the Affordable Care Act because they were entitled to it under federal law, and because that kind of benefit plays a great role in protecting the equality and health of women, and it actually reduces unintended pregnancies and abortions. So we want that to be a benefit that women have, and that's why it was in the Affordable Care Act. What we needed to do, and what I think President Obama rightly did, was to find a way to honor the religious objections of certain employers while also ensuring that women working for most employers who did object to the providing this coverage received it from someone else, in this case, like an insurer, third-party administrator.
Yeah. The Baptist Joint Committee has a long history of rigid protection of religious freedom. I've known most of the leaders of that organization. They were my colleagues. And they opposed the faith-based initiative from the time it was proposed by President George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
How did you move from that environment to a government led by people who promoted the faith-based initiative? Were there internal conflicts or external conflicts for you on that?
Well, I think from the beginning, we had to define what this initiative was going to be, first for the Bush administration and then for the Obama administration. And let me just talk about the Obama administration because that's the
Sure.
administration for which I worked. The president was very clear from the beginning that this initiative was not an initiative to promote religion.
Mm-hmm.
It was an initiative to lift up people who were in need. That was the mission, to serve mm-hmm. people in need. And the means by which we did so was to work with religious and non-religious organizations who wanted to help people in need. So I think very important, first and foremost, was that the purpose was clear. This was not to aid religion or to promote religion. It was to serve people in need and work with faith-based and neighborhood organizations to do so. Secondly, President Obama was also very clear that we were going to consider non-financial partnerships with faith and community groups to be of equal importance as financial partnerships with faith-based and community groups. Now, I think that's those non-financial partnerships, at least, are a broad area of common ground, and I think they have been for years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've seen government far predating the Bush administration working with faith-based organizations to serve people in need in these non-financial relationships, whether it's just, you know, sort of serving as that middle person between government and people who are struggling to get the right information out to people about how to, for example, get high school students to learn how and when to fill out a form to get federal financial aid for their college and university experience.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that? That makes all the difference in students' lives if they can go on to college and have the financial support they need to do so. Well, you know who's been helping them do that for a very long time? All kinds of religious and non-religious groups, whether it's people down in the church basement, you know, helping somebody, a kid, fill out that form and get it in the mail. That's been the kind of non-financial cooperation that government and religious and other organizations have done for a very long time. So President Obama is very clear about that, and I think mm-hmm. that unites all of us.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, the president was very insistent that we do these partnerships when they were all partnerships, but in particular the financial partnerships, that we look carefully at how the Constitution applies, and we make sure that we are respecting the Constitution when we have these financial partnerships. And I believe, Welton, you worked on this too,
sure.
when we were in the Obama administration, to actually reform some of the Bush rules that we felt like didn't adequately
right.
address some constitutional concerns.
Yeah.
And for example, we wanted to make sure that beneficiaries of social services know that they have rights not to be discriminated against, that they do not have to go to a faith-based provider if they request an alternative provider. We have to make good efforts to get them to an alternative provider if they do not want to go to a religious one, and that they should never be pressured to participate in religious activities in order to receive their government benefits, and indeed can't use grant money and contract money to pay for, the religious organization can't use them to pay for explicitly religious activities like worship and religious instruction.
Right.
So with these kind of mandates in mind, you know, I could be on board with this and indeed lead this office, because I felt like these are things that are very much in sync with my values. So I was very comfortable, you know, working for President Obama, who had this vision for the office and implementing it as he instructed.
Well, I want to quickly point out that of all the people who have sat in that office that President Bush launched under the name of the Faith-Based Initiative, you, Melissa, by far, were the most conscientious about what should and should not be done under the guidelines of faith-based money. What's happening in that office right now? Is there still money there, and how is it being used?
Well, thanks for those questions. I think one thing I want to hit on right away is that the White House office doesn't give out money to anybody, never has and never should, or at least, you know, in all of my experience, never has, never should. Well, of course they shouldn't anyway, but the White House office does not make grants, doesn't, you know, execute contracts with people. Instead, what happens is the various federal agencies and their career employees make decisions about who gets, you know, who, based on who applies, who is the most meritorious of the applicants for government aid. And we put some rules in place out of concern that we had heard that there might be in previous times some political pressure on this process. So we put in something in the rules that say there should be no political interference in this process, mm-hmm. because we do not want this to be a system of cronyism. That undermines, you know, the heart of the initiative. So that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as what's going on currently, I can't say that much, because I'm not sure about exactly what's going on. There has been the President Trump put out an executive order more than a year after he took office, striking some of the protections that we worked on for social service beneficiaries and setting up a position of an advisor to what he is calling a Faith and Opportunity Initiative. So I think that was in May of 2018. And then just recently, it was reported that they intend to, or that they have appointed someone to fill that advisor position, but we don't have a lot of information about what they're doing and what this initiative consists of. So I can't really be too helpful on that.
I'm not surprised at that. I personally, Melissa, and I've said this to our listeners over and over again, I think that right now our nation faces the most dangerous threats to religious freedom since the days before passage of the First Amendment. The religious right has made great progress in redefining religious freedom. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think we do have to look at, you know, the Supreme Court's decisions in this area mm-hmm. and think about what they mean. Oftentimes we will find that people have a lot of mistaken impressions about religion's role in public life, about the phrase separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of well-meaning people, they, you know, they're busy with their lives and they haven't given a lot of thought to exactly how this works. So, you know, that, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to say separation of church and state, in my view, doesn't mean that government and religion have nothing to do with one another. Mm-hmm. If they choose to cooperate, they can. But it does mean that there has to be some meaningful independence between the sectors of religion and government for all the reasons I described earlier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that one of the challenges in this area that people on various sides, you know, right and left, can have mistaken impressions about what the Supreme Court has said. And we can help to a large degree in clearing that up. So religion hasn't been kicked out of the public schools. We know that. We've worked on a document that talks about all the ways that students can express their faith in school mm-hmm. while also respecting the fact that the government can't organize or sponsor prayers in public school, that that's not good for anybody, including for the religion that gets endorsed by the school. So, you know, my hope is that we can open up a conversation and invite people of goodwill to the table and recognize that reasonable minds can differ on some church-state questions, not all of them. I don't think there's some that we shouldn't differ on, like protecting the equal rights of people of all faiths and none. But let's come together and let's make the first order of business clearing up confusion and making sure we're actually talking to one another, not past one another. So I guess I hope that the conversation that we have can be a lot better on these issues and that that can help dial down the temperature in this area and that we can make some real progress. Now, is that a silver bullet? No. Are we never going to, because we have those conversations, not differ over some tough issues? No. But we can do a heck of a lot better, I think, by actually trying to talk with one another rather than at one another about these issues.
How do you define religious freedom?
Well, I define religious freedom by the guarantees that are in our Constitution, and that includes the No Religious Test Clause of the Constitution that prohibits the government from placing religious tests on public office. It also includes the No Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses that we've been talking about. And it provides a wonderful guarantee that no one's citizenship should depend on their religiosity or their lack of a religious belief and affiliation. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the bedrock principles that I think of as religious freedom. And they include ideas like religious people have just as much right as do secular voices in speaking out in public on issues that they care about, on meeting with their governmental representatives. So it is a beautiful system that hasn't always operated perfectly, to be sure, but has within it a framework that makes space for everyone and that prohibits both the government from promoting religion and denigrating religion. So it has this very careful balance reflected throughout the guarantees that I think is remarkable and has made the United States exceptional. And what we are entrusted with doing now is hanging on to those guarantees that have made our country one of the most vital in terms of religious observance, and also one of the countries that experiences the greatest freedom for all people, no matter their faith or beliefs.
Well, we're in another election cycle. What do you think we should focus on in terms of faith and public life in an election year? What's your counsel related to the role the rhetoric of faith should play over the next several months?
Well, I think one nonpartisan requirement that we can insist on and hold people of all parties accountable to is not using dehumanizing language, not using language that fearmongers on the basis of religion, race, or ethnicity, or other factors, any factor, but including those, and not using violent imagery that can, you know, although it wouldn't be intended by the speaker, can set people off who are on edge and result in terrible things like the tragedies that we've seen in attacks on houses of worship over the last few years. So one thing that I think we ought to be able to come around together and in a nonpartisan way insist on all of these kinds of things and tell both candidates and current government officials that we're going to be watching their language and we're going to hold them accountable when we think they are breaking these rules. That is something that I think is an easy thing for us to do together. And indeed, there was a letter that was sent to all of our federal representatives not too long ago that sketched out ideas like this and harkened back to the letter that George Washington sent to the Touro Synagogue back around the founding of our country when he said that we should give to bigotry no sanctions, persecution no assistance. So I think we can unite around those kinds of things and really work to hold our leaders accountable to those kinds of standards.
Melissa, if you can do this very succinctly, I want to ask what I think is a very important question. I want you to talk just for a second about why religious freedom should be important for all Americans, regardless of their religion or even opposition to religion.
Right. I think this is part of recognizing human dignity. We all have equal and infinite worth. And a way to do that is respect the rights of conscience and to say that the government shouldn't intrude into that sacred sphere without a very good reason. And so protecting the rights of religious freedom is one way in which we recognize that everyone has equal dignity.
Well said. Melissa Rogers is an attorney, a scholar, and author who served as special assistant to President Barack Obama and executive director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. She's also the former executive director of the Pew Forum on Religion in Public Life and general counsel of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. Today, Melissa is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Her important new book, I hope you'll read it, is titled Faith in American Public Life. Melissa, I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio, thank you. You have helped put this show on the air. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media or in person. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.